Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. And I would like to.
Is
Representative Hayden going to come?
Supposed to come.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2882A, and hopefully Senator Hayden out there will come in. All right.
Rep. Hayden is coming in.
I'll do my best impersonation. It's funny, this is my bill, and he did all the work on it. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is southeast and a little sliver of northeast Portland. And I'm here to testify on House Bill 2882, which is a simple bill that just requires that the governing board, there he is, of coordinated care organizations include at least one representative from a dental care organization, a DCO, on their CCO board of directors. The bill asks that each dental care organization that works with a given CCO, sometimes the CCOs work with several DCOs, not just one, that they would submit a nominee, and then that CCO would choose from among those nominees and their governing board. Like I said, I think it's pretty straightforward. In my time on healthcare, I've learned a lot about how all of our health systems, you know, really intermingle, that it's not a good idea to separate dental and mental and physical health. All these things all work together, and it's just health. And trying to make sure that oral health is integrated into the CCO structure, I think, is what this bill's about, and I hope you'll support it. Now the guy did all the work on the amendment, actually, in the bill.
Thank you, Chair, members.
You address the amendment, please.
The dash.
We don't know about the new one.
The new amendment?
Oh, then we'll wait.
Okay. I can address. I have read it.
You
have done all the work.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, state representative from House District 7. And full disclosure, I am a dentist. this bill, back in 2011, the CCOs were in a forming process. It actually began a little bit earlier than that, but the CCOs were stood up without the dental care organizations. There was a decision made to do that to make sure that physical health coordinated care organizations were able to organize and stabilize with all of the focus done on physical health. About 3 years later, the integration of oral health began. Since that time, of the 16 CCOs, the dental care organizations fall under the governance of the coordinated care organizations, and then the dental work is provided by the dental care organizations. It was the understanding of the dental care organizations that they would be part of the governance board when the CCO legislation was set up as being a major component of the healthcare delivery system. There were discussions about that 3 years later, whether dentistry was a major part of the healthcare delivery system, and it was decided that the CCO could choose whether they were part of that system or not. And when the dental care organizations were included with the CCOs, six CCOs have adopted up to this point some aspect of either a dentist or a dental care organization on the coordinated care organization governance. 10 have not. The concern that I have with that, if you look at on the 27th, the Health Policy Institute presented to you a 25-page report that compared dentistry across all of the states, and Oregon has declined coincidentally. I'm not saying it's directly related, but coincidentally, dental care access has declined since about the same time frame. And so one of the possible concerns that we have is the dental care organizations have been separated from the governance and the policy of the coordinated care organizations. What this bill would do is it would put a dental care organization the opportunity to nominate. Some CCOs have up to 8 dental care organizations that they contract with. And so in the case of the metropolitan area, those 8 dental care organizations would nominate a person, and the CCO would pick or have an election from their governance board one of those 8 people. I don't know if there's any instances where their CCO only has one option, but there's certainly some instances where the CCO would have to pick from 2 or 3 dental care organizations that were nominated by the dental care organizations, because those are the only ones that contract with them. So what this bill would do is it would allow the flexibility of the coordinated care organizations to pick from a representative that was nominated by the dental care organizations. As to the amendment that has been...
Do you know what number it is?
I do not have that up.
Okay,
but
that's all right.
Well, there are only 2. They're dash 1s and dash 3s are the only ones on OLIS.
So, I can... If you can bring the bill up really quickly. So I believe it's a one-line amendment that says that the... Instead of a dental care organization nominating this person for the CCOs to pick from, it would be a risk-sharing organization. Looking at that amendment, what that appears to be when they say risk-sharing, that would include the federally qualified health centers that do, in fact, contract on a much more limited basis with the coordinated care organizations and the dental care organizations. The inclusions of them, I think, is a good idea, but for me, it's a separate topic because they don't deal with, like, the specialty care. If a dental client needs to go to the hospital, that's not going to be done through a federally qualified health center. That's going to be referred back to the dental care organization to do more of the specialty care. And so there is an argument that there is a small amount of risk shared with the federally qualified health centers. I don't dispute that, but it's as much smaller amount of risk shared than the dental care organizations have, because they have the obligation of the entire population, not a small part of them, a small part of the population. So I would not be in support of the, which dash is it?
I don't know.
I don't think it's been drafted by.
Yeah, I was gonna
say, I would not be in support of the proposed amendment, which I saw in an email, but I haven't seen that it's on your OLIS yet.
I like the bill the way we sent it to you.
Because I am not opposed to having federally qualified health center folks involved with the management of coordinated care organizations. I am concerned that it may be a workaround having dental care organizations, and the Health Policy Institute showed that Oregon is losing ground in getting access on a population wide basis for Oregon, losing ground on access to dental care, and we need to be improving that.
Wonderful. Questions?
No, Madam Chair, just for the record, at the very beginning of CCOs, the DCOs were happy to not be on the inside. Okay, so this is part of the evolution. I mean, that's the reality.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay.
True. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Forgive me, I'm not completely familiar with how all the CCO members are selected, but do they all come from stakeholder groups that nominate members and allow the board or whomever to choose which member?
I think it's done in a variety of ways. I know in statute, like, half have to be, or maybe it's by federal from our waiver from CMS. At least like half have to be risk-bearing entities within the... Do you know the answer to this?
I believe I do.
I think people behind you do.
So, yeah, it's basically called out in the organization of the CCOs. It has to be several categories, a major component of the medical system. There have to be physicians. There has to be a mental health, which is called out. A dental care organization was not called out. Oral health was not called out on it because it was considered from the dental people, they thought that that was part of the major health component of it. So it would be unique. This would be unique to get a dental person on the governance board.
I guess I don't In fact, I don't have any concern with having a dental person on the board. My question really is directed to, is the selection process, is it just up to the board like others to say, you have to have a person representative, or this one seems to be, so you have to have a person representative, but you can only choose one of the people that's recommended by the organization?
So it is, yes, thank you for the question. So the bill as written would require that the coordinated care organization select a member that is on or potentially on the governance board of the dental care organization, meaning coordinated care organization is tasked by the state to accomplish metrics and meet certain standards. And the dental care organizations also have that much less as far as numbers of things that they have to meet, but they have standards that they have to meet. And so we're wanting to tie those governance structures together with this bill rather than what voluntarily has happened in three of the six dental care organizations, CCO contracts. There are, I believe, and I could be corrected, there are three dental care organizations currently, that may be four, on the governance of CCOs, but there's also dental care providers that represent that. Although we're not opposed to dental care providers, they aren't necessarily involved with the structure of the dental care organization and the need to get foster children in within a 30 or a 60-day period of time and a need to get sealants and meet these metrics. So the dentists that are involved with the dental care organization understand the global concept of what the dental care organization are trying to accomplish more so than just a provider.
What he said.
Yes, DCOs do have metrics that they have to meet. They are providing the services for the CCOs for the Medicaid population. So, yes. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Jim Bunn and Deborah Loy.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn from Amity. I represent Advantage Dental. I'd also like to mention Dr. Mike Shercliffe would be here testifying, but today he is speaking to the American Dental Association in Chicago, so he can't, but he does have testimony on OLIS. In 1989, I had the privilege of debating on the Senate floor what would become the Oregon Health Plan. It has evolved, as you mentioned, from the original, the idea that Senator John Kitzhaber presented. At times, it's hard to remember some of the details of that evolution. Fortunately, we have good records, including audio of floor sessions. In 2011, House Bill 3650, and a year later, Senate Bill 1580, made huge changes to Oregon's healthcare system. Changes bring fear, and fear brings a need for assurances. DCOs feared being lost in the stampede toward transformation. We asked for and were given assurances that we would be included in governance of the CCOs. This has not happened in most of our CCOs. Speaker Kotek, Representative Freeman, Dr. Bates, and Dr. Steiner Hayward were the four carriers of Senate Bill 1580 in their respective chambers. The first three called out dental in an effort to assure us that we would have a voice on governance of CCOs. On the House floor on February 23, 2012, Representative Freeman, as carrier, stated, quote, Senate Bill 1580 is an important bill that provides the framework to coordinate the major components of the Oregon health care plan. These include but are not limited to physical, mental, behavior, and oral health care. On the Senate floor on February 14th, Senator Bates, as co-carrier, said, quote, it provides structure of the governance requirements, ensures participation of all major providers, including dental MCOs, within the governance structure. And if I can just digress a moment, both the staff measure summary and the current statute, and if you looked at the bill on page 3, the current statute on line 12, each coordinated care organization has a governing body that includes, and then drop down to line 18, the major components of the health care delivery system. Then again, Senator Bates, it provides structure of the governance requirements, ensures participation of all major providers, including dental MCOs within the governance structure. This has been the law for 5 years. The legislative intent was clear. DCOs were to be included in the governance of CCOs. Now, 5 years later, only a few have acted to truly integrate oral health with physical and behavioral health. House Bill 2882 will restore that intent of 1580, putting at least one DCO representative on each CCO board. We're not asking for control, just one seat at the table. And also, just to briefly comment about the proposed amendment, which I obviously haven't seen, if you look at the FQHCs and say they are providing some direct services, it would appear from the limited information I've been able to gather that that's about 4,000 people out of a million, or 0.4%, I think the math would be. So 99.6% of the care is provided through dental care organizations. Now, again, that's doing the math sitting in the back of the room. But I would urge your support of 2882.
Thank you. Deborah.
Thank you, Chairwoman Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We're a dental care organization with the Oregon Health Plan. We've been doing the Oregon Health Plan since its inception in 1994, so we have quite a few years of experience. We're also only a dental care organization, so we don't do any commercial or anything else. This is our business. We have about 300 plus thousand lives that we're responsible for. We contract with 14 of the 16 CCOs. And to speak just a teeny bit to what Jim just mentioned, I went online to see how many lives currently are in the coordinated care organizations and on the state website, and there are 978,379 lives under CCOs. Of those, 99% of those lives are being cared for by the dental care organizations. I contract with roughly almost 600 dental providers throughout the communities I serve. I am a blended model delivery system, so I have staff-affiliated clinics. I have 31 of them that are located throughout my service areas. And as I said, I primarily do Oregon Health Plan. So when I open a specialty practice, it pretty much does Oregon Health Plan. So my pediatric practices are saturated with Oregon Health Plan members that are mine. In fact, one of my coordinated care organizations will be coming to visit one of our pediatric sites in Southern Oregon because they want to explore what we might be doing to touch 57% of our children's lives in a year. So we know this business, and we've been doing this business for a long, long time. I have written testimony, so I'm not going to belabor or go into deep detail for each of the points I make in written testimony, but I will indicate in preparing for this testimony today, I went back to the old statutes and dusted them off to see kind of what they said, to see if they said what I remembered they were supposed to say. And House Bill 3650 indicated the intent of the bill was to take siloed physical, behavioral, and oral health managed care delivery systems and create new organizations called coordinated care organizations. From the very beginning of the transformation, it was seen that these coordinated care organizations would be sort of the tent or the umbrella for the previously siloed managed care delivery systems to come under. So a little bit, I'm always surprised that I feel like I'm supposed to be part of the family instead of always feeling like I'm outside the family. And our staff clinic system actually purchased or had two clinic systems that had operated independently for a long time that we had to blend. And initially when they began to meet together, they all wanted to sit together, like the ones that had been part of the previous clinics wanted to sit just with themselves. We had to rename them. We had to make it a mandate that they started to sit in opposite tables. And after a year or so, they forgot that they were separated. They forgot that they were different clinic systems and became one clinic system. So I'm really hoping that what we can accomplish with this particular legislation is to hopefully get the voice at the governance table for the dental care organizations. And why does it need to be a dental care organization versus a dentist? And I have actually nothing but good things to say about dental providers too. Or why not an FQHC? I actually contract with most of the FQHCs if they're in my service area, and we do so robustly, so they have certainly a big footprint. But most of my dental providers want to not be at risk, so I'm at risk. I pay fee for service. They don't want to, as it's been stated, pick up specialty care, including pediatrics, hospital dentistry, care to those in institutions, and or oral surgery, all of which are very expensive deliveries of dental care. So I take the risk mostly for that. So the current statutory requirements for governance require that persons that share in the financial risk of the organization, and has already been spoken to, the major components of the healthcare delivery system. What makes a dental plan different than a provider for risk, or an FQHC, even if they were going to be at risk, and many are not, they're paid fee-for-service, is I not only am at risk for care, all comprehensive care, but I'm also at risk for holding the reserves for these CCOs. So the dental reserves I have to keep set aside, and I hold those. I'm at risk potentially should the CCO not have a timely encounter that could trigger an OHP penalty, and I would have to share in that payment of that penalty, whether I caused it or not, because I am part of the organization. I'm at risk for helping to make sure that CCO meets its contract requirements, including its quality improvement metrics. So I share a much deeper level of risk than any dental provider could possibly do, including an FQHC, even if they were at risk. Many of the FQHCs are county health departments, which already sit at the governance table in many CCOs. Many FQHCs already are on the boards of the CCOs, whether they're a county government or not. So I would not want to, you know, again, if a CCO or even a dental plan wanted to put forth a federally qualified health center, that's certainly not to take away from what they can bring to the table, but they do not take the place of the significant risk sparing that the dental care organizations do, nor the experience in the delivery system that we bring to the table. What have I seen that sometimes can come out of not being at the table? It's been a long, long time, often since any of our leadership has been able to get to meet with the leadership of the CCOs, so we're certainly not in frequent conversations or having an opportunity to be in frequent conversations with CCO leadership. Many times the people we deal with most day-to-day and operationally are middle-level managers who certainly have a value, but they cannot make decisions necessarily or commit the CCO to strategic plans or any other types of transformational type activities. So certainly there's a disconnect between the dental care organizations and the governance structures of the CCOs in many ways. One of my CCOs, actually, most of my CCOs have all of their care done through our dental care organizations. One does have a direct contract with an FQHC. I also contract with that same FQHC. In that particular CCO, I'm at a point where I am actually spending more money to provide care than I'm taking in for revenue. And I've been trying to get an audience to try to flush out what's going on. But some of that could be the unintended consequences of contracting with the direct provider, who's also a provider of me, my own organization, without necessarily figuring out all the nuances of what that might look like, especially as it comes down to bearing risk for specialty care in the service area. So that's one particular issue I've been trying to raise up the food chain and that particular CCO. Another example is most of my CCOs are using a computer algorithm to assign members rather than letting the member make choice at the front end. I believe one of our CCOs that there's a glitch in the algorithm, which means that I feel like it's not assigning as we would anticipate. And again, I've been trying to get that up kind of the chain of command to have it addressed. These are operational issues to me as a risk-bearing entity that without a key voice, I don't have the ability to problem solve any of them on my own. The other is with the computer algorithm, I've actually been a champion of the FQHCs and trying to get my CCOs to consider having the computer algorithm look to see, is this person assigned medically to an FQHC so that they can drop them into dental plans that contract with that FQHC, and haven't really had much traction for that particular issue either. So I certainly don't think being on the board is a panacea. But as a dental care organization, I do hope to be part of the problem-solving solutions for transformation, to hopefully be a value added. We are actually on the board of WVCH, Willamette Valley Community Health, not necessarily just as a dental plan. We're actually part owner of that CCO, so I know my own boss says being on the board doesn't mean it's a win-all, end-all, win-all. But I do hope that in being on the board, a dental plan person can add to the strategic planning, the transformational efforts, and be a good thing, not a bad thing. But change is hard, just like we had to sort of do with our clinics where we had to mix them up. People tend to gravitate to what they already have.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator
Knope. Thank you. Jim, I wasn't here in 2011, 2012. And I heard your testimony, and I'm reading it here online. So I just want to clarify. The carriers of the bills in 2012 indicated pretty specifically that DCOs were going to be part of the kind of the management and this decision-making process. And in fact, that's happened with six of them, but not with 10. And so this bill, you're saying, is just kind of codifying what has already been, was already committed to in 2012 when the bill passed.
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, absolutely that is the case. We believe this bill should never have needed to be brought to the legislature. We think that the statute was explicit, and that as Senator Cruz mentioned, the evolution, there was a problem that because we were to be phased in, that CCOs did not begin with a DCO on their board. Now, Capital Dental is on two, Willamette is on two, Advantage is on two, and the other 10, to my knowledge, have no representative. So we're one of three silos, and yet in the majority of the CCOs, including HealthShare, which has all nine DCOs, there's no board member from a DCO. And again, the statute says the major components, and unless you believe that one of those three silos is not a major component, how could you avoid, if you're complying with the statute, doing that? But then Senator Bates and Representative Freeman, again, Senator Bates, it provides structure of the governance requirements, ensures participation of all major providers, including dental MCOs, within the government's governance structure. And MCO, by the way, is the same as DCO. It's just on the floor. He used the term MCO. There is no difference in the meaning on those. But thank you for that question.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Fawn Berry, Nancy Avery, Matt Sinnott and Courtney Johnson are the ones left. Okay. Chairwoman DeSanderson and committee members, for the record, my name is Nancy Avery. I'm the manager of dental services for Moda Health. I'm responsible for the oversight of our dental Medicaid line of business, which is branded under ODS. We're responsible for over 134,000 members in 13 CCO service areas. You have received written testimony from our dental director, Dr. Terry Barrichello, and I'm here today to present a few points as communicated in her letter. We firmly support Oregon's healthcare transformation goals and objectives and are committed to them through Eastern Oregon Coordinated Care Organization and ODS. I'm here today to ask for an amendment. We appreciate Representatives Nose and Hayden's efforts to fully integrate dental care into the CCO health care transformation agenda. However, to legislate the nomination process of a board seat sets a precedent far beyond the intent of this bill. I also wanted to add, to achieve meaningful integration, it's far more important that it be defined, an expectation of its inclusion in community health improvement plans, CHIPs, be set by the legislature, and this is currently being considered in other bills. Once defined by the legislature, the follow-through and actual creation of the CHIP plans happen in the CCO community structure and not at the board level. It is critical that the DCO perspective be included during the formation stage. I also wanted to add a couple other topics as far as oral health and physical health integration, how the CCOs and DCOs can and do work together, such as selecting a CCO quality measure that focuses on integration between CCOs and DCOs. For example, oral evaluation for adults with diabetes and follow-up after ED visits for dental services. The quality measures have historically brought entities together to work on new initiatives to improve results, and this is shown by the evidence in improved quality measure performance throughout the state. In addition, the CCO performance improvement projects, similar to the transformation plans, the CCO performance improvement project could improve focus on dental integration. So in summary, we think the state, in collaboration with the CCOs and DCOs, should continue to work together to better define what integration may look like in their communities rather than mandating another board seat. Thank you.
Okay. We're Drew Straws. All right. Good afternoon, Chair Modus Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, my name is Matt Sennett, and I serve as Director of Government Affairs and Contracts with Willamette Dental Group. We appreciate the opportunity to comment today regarding House Bill 2882A. We also believe we're uniquely qualified to weigh in on this bill, as we are a subcontracted dental partner to 11 CCOs. We serve roughly 85,000 CCO Medicaid members statewide, and we do have two representatives on CCO Board of Directors, one layperson and one dentist. As drafted, we do not support the bill, but we do support the amendment that is not not filed yet, but is elusively out there in the wind. However, we do and largely support that because we do believe that assuring oral health is incorporated within all CCO structural hierarchy is a critically important element. I think we've heard some of my dental colleagues already raise the fact that it was unequivocally clarified as a major component of the healthcare delivery system as it relates to the coordinated care model. And we also believe oral health is transformational. After all, oral health is upstream care, it is primary care, and it is prevention. Yet our experience as a partner to 11 CCOs, including those two seats in governance, it's taught us that prescriptive approaches tend to actually impede, not enable, transformation. As drafted in a prescriptive manner, constricting CCO choice through a mechanization that also establishes a new precedent for governance appointment is concerning, and does it actually get us to the outcome we seek without creating unintended consequences? We also do have concerns with the use of DCO, or dental care organization, as that definition has been interpreted to apply to our sort of the entities we were before we were reincarnated under CCO structures. In other words, it's tied to a relationship between the OHA and a dental organization for a direct contract, which would now reflect OpenCart. And that ambiguity concerns us because Willamette actually, upon integrating with our 11th CCO, we closed our OpenCart contract to focus our attention on our CCO partnerships. With that being said, for us, it's not actually about the fact that technically the language as drafted could force CCO partners to replace both Willamette representatives on their board. And, you know, candidly, it's actually not about Willamette serving in governance whatsoever. And we want to be sure we're clear on that. The question really we should all be asking is why? What is the point behind this? Is the juice worth the squeeze? What's gained? What's lost? These are important questions because for us, it is all about the intent. What are we trying to achieve? If the answer is transformation, inclusive of oral health, via the coordinated care model, we do not see 2882A as drafted as the ideal vehicle to necessarily get us there. There's a couple key reasons, and I'll make it brief because some of my colleagues have already raised them. We actually believe that the CCO structural hierarchy, all of what underlies the board of directors, is actually the most critical piece of this puzzle. I do sit as the layperson representing Willamette in Trillium CCO's board of directors, and so I can't speak with experience there. We believe that a lot of the groundswell, a lot of what we speak to on integration, coordination, and how do we get further faster is not something that is sort of blessed or not at a board level. A lot of that is sort of percolated up through work that is done at committee levels, at subcommittee levels, and all of those settings that underlie the board and that create the material for the board to ultimately make decisions on. Secondly, we think that, as my colleague Nancy alluded, what we call sort of the governance playbook regarding the CHIP plans, the transformation plans, if those pieces, which I know this session we're making progress on, if those do include oral health, and that becomes the basis with which CCOs are making their decisions operationally, financially, strategically, because they have to deliver on those promises, that is a better mousetrap to help support how do we get oral health further faster. Again, if it's about transformation inclusive of oral health, then the governance seat is not, it's arguably a symptom, not the root cause. We also, as alluded earlier, do believe that prescribing may impede. We're not necessarily sure that setting, as Senator Beyer alluded, this mechanization of having a nomination process instituted is a new precedent. That does not exist in any other board appointment to our knowledge after reading statute and experience in 11 of the 16 CCOs. Plus, we believe that that may actually start to undermine how truly community-based a governance structure might be. At that point, all of the board of directors would be filled by a DCO-nominated representative, period. No ability to look at any other options. And I'm not suggesting that there's better options. I'm just saying, is that actually what we want? It's probably a rhetorical and unanswerable question. Not only does this approach potentially forego the CCO's ability to consider non-DCO nominated oral health representatives, it also means the candidate pool is categorically and arbitrarily constricted. To avoid this scenario, we would suggest amending the language to base CCO choice on reflecting employed and or contracted clinical and non-clinical representatives from risk-bearing contractors. There is a definition in statute right now, prepaid managed care health service organization, which means a dental managed care, mental health, or chemical dependency organization that contracts with the authority under ORS 414-654 or with a coordinated care organization on a prepaid capitated basis to provide health services to medical assistance recipients. We think that does really more emblematically represent what I think all folks were talking about today. In closing, ultimately, we do believe strongly that oral health should be meaningfully incorporated into all CCO structural hierarchies. However, flexibility must be reasonably afforded to ensure community-based representation. Having said that, we are not purporting governance is a linchpin, let alone a mission-critical transformational consideration, and by no means a transformational silver bullet. Rather, we believe the hierarchical structure underlying the board and elements that govern the activities of the board, such as the CHIP and the transformation plan, not only are they closer to a silver bullet, arguably they could be more of the golden gun in this case. Thanks for your time today, and I take any questions you have.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, wait, Fawn and Corey. Let's let Fawn and, yeah, let's get the testimony and then have the questions. Go ahead, Fawn.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn Berry representing Moda Health, and my apologies, I am the drafter of the elusive amendment that everyone keeps referring to. I just wanted to put on the record, our main concern was with the nominating process, as Matt alluded to. There's no other position within the CCOs that has a nominating process in statute, so that was the main concern coming from us. And the language was drafted the way that it is because we wanted to make sure that Willamette was included in that process. So if there's some discussion about language limitations or how that should be changed, we're open to that, but the nomination process is our main concern.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Courtney Johnston. I'm here today representing Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is a coalition of 8 of the 16 CCOs and their affiliated organizations that provide Medicaid to about half of the state's Medicaid recipients. We are absolutely in support of the idea of updating statutes to continue to reflect transformation efforts. However, in every other case in the statute now, for physical and for behavioral health, it says that a provider will be serving on our boards. And we think that dental integration is no different and that it should be consistent with the current statutes. We have several concerns with this bill. Our boards are representative of the population we serve and the providers we work with. We think that the fact that our boards are made up of local community members is an important accountability measure. And I have concerns that this bill will be that DCO representatives from Portland may have to serve on my boards in Klamath Falls or in Coos Bay, or that by simply how narrow this bill is, that we may be in a situation where a board member for an organization that's headquartered in Boston will be sitting on my boards. And so we want to have the flexibility to allow for us to pick the right people in our communities. We have the same concerns that you just heard about the mechanism for choosing the board members. But as you've heard, integration does not happen by putting a board of a subcapitated entity or putting a board member of a subcapitated entity on our boards. I have members within COHO that have DCO board members and members that have other oral health providers, and integration is no different across those boards. You've heard a lot about the importance of dental representation on our CCO boards. And I don't know of any of my CCOs that don't have dental representation. It's just not the representation that that is a DCO board member, and that's what you're hearing from these folks. So we support the amendment that's in the works or that's being discussed that we think would improve this policy to allow CCOs the flexibility to represent dental on their boards in the way that makes the most sense for their communities. Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So see if I understand where you're going with the amendment. You support the idea that the CCO should have a DCO member on their board. You just believe that the choice of whom that person is should be left up to the CCO board to choose?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Beyer, from our perspective, yes, that's our position.
Okay.
I have a question. I am most concerned about the strategic planning that needs to be done, and that sometimes, and I'm not saying Willamette Dental doesn't have that expertise, but a regular dentist from the community doesn't get involved in that strategic planning on reimbursements, on the operational issues. So I need to be convinced that just a regular dentist would have that type of expertise in the strategic planning process. Maybe that's for you, Matt.
Yeah, no, and I do think it's a great question. So, Chair Motis Anderson, thanks for the question. I would say, you know, it is not a binary scenario where whatever language we craft is either going to create success every scenario or it'll create failure in every scenario. I'd say for us, I think, you know, even within a dental care organization or a dental subcontractor, using those terms of art, I think you could find that even there you may not get the right dentist able to really be effective at that type of strategic conversation. Frankly, we believe that it's not about one person. And, you know, whether you put a DCO rep or an oral health provider on the board that's a national researcher, that person is by themselves not going to be effective at making the strategic decisions for all of dental. We think this is a bilateral scenario. That person on the board should be subject matter familiar and effective at that level of decision making. But it's about how that person interacts back to the other dental plans and how the dental plans use that individual as a conduit or as a vehicle to carry additional messages to the board. Because they're not representing an organization, they are representing all of the dental contractors for the CCO.
But does Willamette Dental have the same matrix needing to meet certain standards that each DCO does with OHA?
In our CCO relationships, we are all basically on a even playing field in terms of what we're all expected to do and sort of what the targets are we're shooting at. So we're not treated differently in that regard, if I mm-hmm. answered your question correctly.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, another example I'd use, Chair Motis Anderson, is I recently did get to participate in the Trillium CCO's board retreat. And we did take a lot of time to talk about dental and frame what can we do going forward and how do we start to facilitate the right meeting settings to get coordination and integration dialogue happening. Because you don't start to create change if you don't first have the right folks around the table with the right relationships and the right conduits to communicate amongst various tiers of an organization.
Further questions?
Yeah, I have one.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you. I'm a little confused. I'm looking at the history of this bill, and I noticed that it was 58-0 coming out of the House. And my rep is a chief sponsor of the bill. I'm a sponsor. So my question is a process question. So it sounds like there's an amendment out there. So my question is was this concept discussed in the House? And if it wasn't, why not? Because it was clearly unanimously bipartisan coming over here. So I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, what the process was and why we're seeking an amendment now.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Knope, we did offer amendments on the House side. You'll see in the meeting materials there was a letter signed by a majority of the CCOs, if not all 16, opposing the amendment that they did include in the bill. There was a drafting problem with the amendment that was submitted, and it was specifically an oral health provider. It wasn't a DCO or this language about a risk-bearing entity. So there were some problems with the amendment, and frankly, they just pushed ahead with the amendment that was drafted. So, but we did submit opposition for the record.
I don't want to bring up that 58 people decided no, that they weren't going to do that. But I'm looking at the record. Can you tell me which
It was submitted by Ashlyn Strong, and it says multiple CCOs. I think it's maybe like fifth down on the list.
It's pretty good. I'm not seeing it, but...
Under the meeting materials?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay. We have some contemplating to do. I would like you to actually meet with Jim Bunn and Deborah Loy to see if you can come to consensus. That is my ideal, rather than just sending an amendment down without you guys having collaborated with them. That would be the most efficient and best way, I think, for me, and I'm not sure how the rest of the committee feels.
And Chair Monis-Anderson, I would say that we had suggested to them in the House side that if they dropped the language about the nomination process, that we would be okay with it. The issue about Willamette is something that I just became aware of. But they were not willing to drop the nomination process.
Okay, well, we'll see what we can do. All right. Thank you very much, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2882 and open a public hearing on 2838.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, House Bill 2838A requires the Oregon Health Authority to provide grants to independent nonprofit organizations to give application assistance to individuals eligible for Medicaid. No amendments, and testimony is available on OLIS.
All right, Martin Taylor, Lisa Anderson, Alicia Temple, and Natasha Pileschi. And we'll have to go a little bit faster on this bill than we did the last one. So hopefully this isn't as controversial.
Senator Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing Care Oregon and its affiliated CCOs, Jackson Care Connect and Columbia Pacific CCO. Also, for the record, I don't change jobs till June 1st. So any of you who are wondering that's the jersey I'm wearing. I want to first let you know that the most important testimony that we gave in the House side actually came from a wide range of our members. We did not bring the members here today, fill your room. It felt a little unnecessary since the bill passed with the overwhelming bipartisan support in the House side, and I don't think there's a lot of controversy, and that's a big effort for low-income people to make the journey to Salem. I do have some other folks on the panel today that can give you a little better definition of the problem we're trying to solve. I do want to recognize that this is a bill that actually is more than a year in the making. It's a bill that we spent some time working with OHA in the 2015 session and over the last 2 years. It's represented quite a shift in the OHA's thinking about enrollment, and I think Representative Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer deserve a lot of credit in working with OHA to get to this point. But it's a really important bill, and you'll see from the sign-on letter that there are quite a few organizations that work closely with the low-income population that also made this bill possible. To be honest, this bill is here because for the last several years, the members of Care Oregon's Member Advisory Committee, low-income people that meet monthly to tell us how we can do our job better, have indicated that the number one biggest concern that they have, albeit a little episodically, but that they have is there are periods of time where it is incredibly difficult to get through the enrollment process. And for segments of our population, it's extraordinarily challenging because they face either language barriers, disability barriers, geographic barriers, literacy barriers, or simply the system has changed 4 times in the last 4 years or so. They simply have the barrier of not knowing what the system looks like at that point in time. Our members really put this on our agenda, and I'd really like to give a compliment to Care Oregon as I leave, that this is the kind of activity where you bring forward for the members as their advocate the kinds of bills that are really most important to the people that we serve. And I want to thank Tamara Petrogetti, who works for me, because she's the one that really has more to do with getting the members involved in all this than anyone else. So just a quick bit of history. There have been periods of time in the last 4 years where we've changed the technology by which people enroll. We've opened or closed access points like county enrollment offices. We've had application assisters, but sometimes more and sometimes less. more people or fewer people have been eligible and their benefits have changed. And in all of those processes, we create confusion in the population that we serve. Those folks call their plan when they need to re-enroll. Same as you would. If you were trying to renew your insurance, you'd call Kaiser or Providence or Regents or Moda or whoever you had, Pacific Source, don't leave anybody out, but you'd call them and said, hey, I'm having an issue with re-enrollment. That's the natural thing to do. And the way the system has been structured is when they call us, what we have to tell them is, we can't help you. But we'll transfer you or roll you over to a phone service at the Oregon Health Authority, where periodically they may experience delays of hours, or they may never get service on a phone line, simply because OHA gets overwhelmed. Our feeling is that we can do a better customer service job than simply referring folks to a state system that's in overwhelm. It's taken some time, but that's now the OHA's point of view as well. And that's actually a really important step. We can establish more trust and do a better job as CCOs, not just for the members, but frankly, by making CCOs partners in the enrollment process, we can do process improvement for the Oregon Health Authority as well. A great deal of the work to help someone enroll can be done by the many hundreds of customer service representatives CCOs have across the state and not rely entirely on the state system. I'm not going to go through the entire history of where we've been with the OHA, because the most important thing to say about the OHA is in this last year, Lynn Saxton's leadership, along with Varsha, have really come to what I would describe as almost a paradigm shift. They now see the possibility of CCOs as being problem solvers in the enrollment space, where before we were seen as intruding on a lane that OHA owned. And I think that change in their thinking is going to be a tremendous service both to the members themselves, but to how CCOs operate. So this bill really does, it does a lot of things, but it does three major things. The first is it allows us to get to a level of data integrity. One of the problems in the current system is that when the members move, the CCOs learn about it because we are obligated to send them mail, sometimes first class, and we get a return address. Or we learn from our provider systems that there's a different address. But we can't update that information in the MMIS system. And when the state sends us a file each week, they replace any good information back with the information they have. This bill is going to create a process where CCOs can help update addresses when we have better information than the state. For the last several years, we've been collecting email addresses as part of the application process, and those email addresses have not been going back to the CCOs. The email address frequently is the thing that follows a member when they change physical addresses. So if you need to notify a member of a change in benefit, a change in provider, or simply inform them that they're due to terminate from their plan and they need to re-enroll, an email address is frequently both a less expensive and a more effective method. This bill will get us those email addresses. The second thing it does is it really makes clear that the CCOs and OHA are partners, and it says that CCOs in non-competitive areas will be able to do any enrollment activities allowed under federal law, and it sets up an advisory committee of stakeholders to help OHA think about what are the most effective ways to improve enrollment. That's going to be really, really helpful. It would be nice to be able to extend that to CCOs in competitive areas, but I think we're taking this as a one-step-at-a-time process, and there's still some concerns that CCOs in competitive areas may see this more as a market share competition thing as opposed to just doing it for the integrity of helping members. So we'll take that for where it's at right now. I think it's really important. Most of our state has one CCO, and in those areas, they'll be able to do any enrollment help allowed under federal law. And finally, it makes a commitment to application assisters. Application assisters, and you'll hear more about them, are the single most effective way of helping people enroll who face any number of barriers, whether it's language, culture, geography, disability. And those application assisters probably have done more direct service for folks who are in an emergency situation where they find out that they're no longer enrolled, when they're at a pharmacist or a mental health provider, and they need help right then. So I'll leave it to the application assisters to talk a little bit more about their job, but it creates a ratio in statute which will create stability to that workforce and allow us to keep the high-quality folks that we've been training. It also allows CCOs to voluntarily contribute additional money in the form of grants that would run through OHA and then fund additional application assisters. Care Oregon has been willing to do this, and we've been told that we can't help, say, let's say in Columbia Pacific, where we had a facility in the Astoria region. There's no competition. There's one CCO out there. We wanted to just do a community benefit grant to have a clinic system be able to do application assistance, and as a result of our grant, they were not given an application assister. This bill changes that. It says it's fine for CCOs to do that. We simply have to do it through the state. The bill lays out a process that includes specific language that says one of the criteria for getting the grant is they can't express a bias for one CCO over the other. Of course, if there is only one CCO, then there's no bias. It's just one. And I think that's going to be a really important step, because I know that CCOs are willing to step up, particularly when they're trying to help specific segments of the population that they know they're having a problem reaching. You'll hear a good example of that in a moment, too. Last thing I want to say on the assister grants is that Care Oregon's most successful program around assisting folks is really connected to the homeless population in downtown Portland. So we go to downtown homeless shelters in a program called Go Mobile, and we help those folks navigate to whatever they need. It doesn't even have to be health care. If it happens to be health care, we have a related assister from Central City Concerns or one of the other local clinics come with us, and we refer them to that assister, and that assister helps them out. Now, if there's a concern that we're trying to get a competitive advantage by getting more folks enrolled in Care Oregon, I would simply say, we're going to the homeless shelters. This is not where you would go if you're trying to get the folks you're going to make money off of. This is literally a public service. We're getting folks who probably have the greatest need and the greatest health cost. We're doing it because this is the population that needs the help. Application assister's job is not to go and get you the healthiest population. It's the job of the application assister's to go get you the populations that otherwise get no service at all, and they frequently have the greatest health need. Finally, I think we really need to focus on the fact that this is not about CCOs or CCOs being competitive or anything like that. This is literally a population in the Medicaid system that often encounters the state as a barrier instead of a partner. And application assisters are what the state does to pull down that barrier. This is the relationship between you and our members, not between you and the CCO. There is an amendment that we are going to bring forward. It's really a technical fix. In the House side, the definition of application assisters was a little narrow for the folks that represent public health agencies. We're fine with their amendment, and I don't anticipate that amendment will be controversial. That's the end of my testimony, but I want to give a minute for the other folks in the panel to give you a little better description of the problem we're trying to solve. Thanks.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Anderson with Care Oregon Member Services. We get a lot of calls from our members after they've called the Oregon Health Plan, and because of their high call volume, they call us seeking help because they're just not able to re-enroll. Unfortunately, we can't help them re-enroll, but we do give them resources where they can call to get re-enrolled, where they can go. And we get a lot of members that are very frustrated. They say we don't have minutes on our phone to hold, you know, with the Oregon Health Plan. They don't have transportation. They don't have computers. And some of our members just don't have the tools to complete their Oregon Health Plan application on their own. So they're really reaching out, really expecting us to help them, which we would like to help them, but we can't. Members that are able to file applications online are finding that their coverage still gets terminated after 30 or 60 days. And a lot of times our members are facing medical difficulties trying to access care when their benefits have expired. Some of the members that thought that they re-enrolled online and everything was fine, or they turned in their applications, call us frantic. They're at the pharmacy trying to get their insulin or their blood pressure medication, and they find that they can't fill it because their coverage is terminated, and they ask us for help. And of course, we have to go back to the other resources, and then they voice their frustration with all the resources that are provided just because of some of the barriers that some of our members face. Members are calling, finding out that they've lost their coverage when their surgery has been pre-authorized and they've been waiting for months. And their surgeries are getting canceled, and some of our members that were lost their coverage and got reinstated are finding they're being put on the wrong CCO and having to pre-authorize that surgery over again. So it's really been difficult and sometimes harmful to the members' health. Also, during the school enrollment years, we've got a lot of calls from moms trying to get their kids vaccinated for school but find the coverage has been terminated when they go to the doctor appointments, and they reach out for help. We do give them the other areas to go, and they are very frustrated because the kids are not able to get back in school until their coverage is reinstated and they have those vaccinations. So it's just been a real pain point for our members, and there's been some barriers for them. So they definitely have, would, there'd be added value to having more sisters out there working with our members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Alicia Temple. I'm the Deputy Director at the Coalition of Community Health Clinics, and here to request your support for House Bill 2838. CCHC is made up of 15 clinics and 40 locations throughout the Portland metro area. Our mission is to improve health care for vulnerable populations. We achieve this by strengthening community health clinics, promoting health equity, and fostering collaboration across the safety net delivery system. This past year, our clinic saw over 54,000 patients. They had and had over 280,000 visits. Of those patients, 93% have incomes below 200% of the poverty level. 51% of patients are covered by OHP, and another 24% are uninsured. CCHC has been partnering with the state to provide OHP enrollment since 2013. We started when it was Cover Oregon. Now we're using the One system. Our sisters have adapted to all the changes that have occurred, and as you've heard, there have been many. We are continually training our enrollment assisters on the changing best practices, new technology, call center procedures, and everything else that's involved in applying. OHA has a great team of people who are dedicated to making enrollment work as efficiently as possible, and I have continually been impressed by their persistence and commitment to solving problems with us. But the reality is that there are still a lot of problems with the system. Community partners like us are an integral part of making the enrollment system work. We are the boots on the ground. We talk the clients through their confusion. We hear their frustration, and we see them year after year as they struggle through the renewal process. They really come to trust us, and they come back and see us when they have helped them next time around. In theory, the need for enrollment assisters would decrease over time, but our experience tells us that isn't the case. As you're going to hear from Natasha, people need help year after year. And recently all the national conversations about healthcare and eligibility creates a whole new level of confusion. Our communities are hearing competing messages, and we're who they call when they want to know if Medicaid still exists or if they can still go to their doctor. They call the person who helped them enroll. They call their community partner. We've worked to establish trusting relationships with our communities over the last 4 years, and the insufficient funding for enrollment undermines both the hard work we've been doing and everything OHA is trying to do to help make these systems work. The unstable funding and changing community partners creates unnecessary instability in an already confusing system. We know that funding is limited and that OHA has to allocate enrollment dollars all around the state, and so HB 2838 is a common sense solution to help get more enrollment and to make help strengthen community partners. More funding for enrollment would ensure that no one falls through the cracks. It would help improve the stability of the enrollment system, and it would allow for consistency in relationships that OHP members have built with us, their community partners.
Thank you. Natasha.
Yeah, well, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the Committee on Healthcare. My name is Natasha Pilecci, and I'm an application assistant with the Coalition of Community Health Clinics. I've been helping people enroll in OHP since 2014. I primarily work with the Russian-speaking community and also the metro area safety clinics. Oregon has the second highest Russian-speaking population that is Medicaid eligible. So in the past few years, I've been busy. I've had over 6,000 interactions helping people enroll. I also educate people about OHP. How to enroll and where to get medical services. In Portland metro area, there are 4 Russian radio stations, and I've been on them all, answering callers' questions about OHP. I've been trained extensively by OHA. I complete annual trainings for both OHP and the marketplace. I attend a monthly collaborative training, and I'm constantly receiving updates through the shared website and a newsletter. After 3 years, I consider myself very experienced and knowledgeable about enrollment. The process of signing up for OHP is difficult for many people. In the 3 years I've been an assister, the process has changed more times than I can count. Many of my clients come back to me to renew their coverage. because the process has changed for them when they first time applied. Just this week, a client came to see me for the third time. She moved the past year and didn't receive her renewal notice. She's in the middle of medical treatment and was very worried she might lose her coverage. I was able to help her on the spot, and she was very relieved. Situations like this happen all the time. People are often frustrated and confused about what to do. I'm happy that I've had the privilege to help people to get the care they need. Unfortunately, CCHC, Coalition of Community Health Clinics, didn't receive the OHA enrollment grant this year, and my job will end on June 30th. I know that funding is limited, and OHA has to make tough decisions every year about what to fund to do this week, this work. That's why we need this bill. House Bill 2838 will help everyone by allowing more funding to go to organizations that are doing the work, have trained their sisters, and want to keep helping our communities. Thank you.
Question. Also, thank you, Martin, for coming ahead of time to brief at least, I think, most of us on the bill. All right. Thank you very much. Let's have Art, and I'll blow your last name, Sujazerski, and Courtney Johnson.
I don't know if Courtney's here.
That's all right. We'll start with you.
Hello again. Chair Monis Anderson, thank you for the opportunity to testify with concerns about House Bill 2838. My name is Art Suhozhevsky, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Family Care Health. Family Care Health is the second largest coordinated care organization in the state with 4,000 providers delivering integrated physical, dental, and behavioral health care to approximately 120,000 Oregonians in the Tri-County region. House Bill 2838 will do a number of things that we have serious concerns with. First, the bill will open the door to bias in the application and enrollment process by allowing CCOs to fund application assisters and recommend to OHA what nonprofits can do this work. The bill would violate the independence of the OHP enrollment process. If a nonprofit receives money from a CCO or is recommended by that CCO, it makes a lot of sense that this nonprofit would be much more likely to steer applicants into a preferred CCO. If the intent of the legislature is to ensure that Oregonians are provided unbiased assistance in applying or re-enrolling for OHP members, you should oppose this bill. Second, the bill does not treat all OHP members equally when they seek re-enrollment assistance from their CCO. This bill would prevent individuals residing in any service areas with more than one CCO from receiving direct application or re-enrollment assistance. This means that the bill would prohibit family care from helping our members re-enroll back into family care, even if they call us for help. Obviously, we want to help our members, and that is why we are opposed to this bill. Lastly, I would like to draw the committee's attention to the provision in the bill that requires OHA to train CCOs on using the state's enrollment database. Although this provision has good intentions, it is useless to us because we do not currently have access to this database. Additionally, as stated in the fiscal impact statement, this provision may require additional funding. We are concerned that this could potentially redirect OHA resources from fixing the enrollment and eligibility system. New trainers will cost $183,000 a biennium. On top of that, the OHA may need even more money to comply with the bill's requirements that there be one application assister for every 1,000 OHP members. That translates to about 2 hours per family care member, 120,000 members. That's quite a lot of time. Our opposition to this bill does not mean that we are opposed to application assisters acting as independent and unbiased advocates for Oregonians in the Oregon Health Plan. But adding more application assisters at a potential cost to the state is not the solution. Devoting additional resources to pile up more applications for the OHA to process would solve nothing and would be an inefficient use of taxpayer funds. There's actually a bill, I will say, that left the House Committee 2979 that's in the Joint Ways and Means Committee that would do a lot more to help resolve the enrollment process. Because the application and enrollment process must remain independent and fair, we're urging the committee to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Courtney Johnston here on behalf of Coalition for Healthy Oregon. I think you heard a lot today about enrollment issues, but COHO has been very concerned about enrollment issues at the agency level and these structural problems. I'm not going to get into that, but we understand this bill is not aimed at fixing these systematic issues, but we appreciate any mechanism that supports the experience of OHP members as they navigate the enrollment system. Having said that, there's a couple of things I want to get on the record today. We really appreciate the language in this bill aimed at ensuring grant recipients provide objective, unbiased information to potential enrollees. It's very important consumer support to help enrollees understand their options. However, we want to make sure that there's the proper oversight of these organizations to ensure that's the case. I understand there's no fiscal on this bill, so it's unclear to me how OHA will enforce this federally necessary requirement. And we just want to make sure there's some assurances that this is enforced. I also appreciate the fact that Section 2 sub C allows CCOs to provide application assistance as long as, but then it specifies as long as the enrollee is in the area served by only one CCO. Again, this is a great improvement in providing some flexibility for CCOs to do our part in helping members navigate this process. Not only does it take some stress off the agency, but as you can imagine, it's very confusing for CCO members who call their CCO and want help with re-enrollment, and we have to tell them to go back and call the agency, and then they have to go through that whole process. But we wanted to get on the record that we think there is some flexibility in the federal regs that could allow CCOs in shared geographic areas where more than one CCO is providing the service to assist in enrollment. So we would like to see the agency work with the federal government to allow employees at all CCOs, regardless of how many serve the area, to provide choice counseling and assist members throughout the state. There's a lot more work to be done on this, but we just want to thank you for your time.
So I have a couple of questions. I'm a little confused on the process of enrollment, and how would it prevent one of your clients from re-enrolling? You had stated in your second point, mm-hmm. preventing re-enrollment. Can you explain that process again to me?
So, I mean, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of members that call us for direct assistance for re-enrolling because perhaps they are on fee-for-service and need to get back to a coordinated care organization to access our provider network. And right now we have to shift them over to the OHA to have the OHA provide that assistance. Obviously, that isn't working. We would like to have that interaction with them and re-enroll them in that 5 or 10 minute phone call, whatever it would take. The language right now does not allow us to do that, except for geographic regions where there's only one CCO.
Okay, so that to me is a key issue. For me, because it seems like if they would call, then they go back to OHA, yet you're not able to have assisters, and I just need to know why you and your organization couldn't have assisters.
Well, assisters in that work directly for family care health, no. There are, obviously, as you've heard, application assisters that are not affiliated directly with a coordinated care organization that do help members apply for and receive enrollment in OHP. Those exist today. I believe the number is at least one for every 10,000, if not more than that. The original bill actually was one for every 10,000, and then OHA came back and said, this is my understanding, that they already have that's the current population of application assisters presently in the state. So that's why my understanding is that's why the bill was changed for one for every 1,000.
Okay. Well, all I know is I'd like equity in the system. I don't want one CCO to be biased over the other. And I'm still not familiar enough with the bill to understand how we can make it so that it is equitable. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, let's go on. Thank you very much. Ashlyn Strong, Jesse O'Brien, John Mullen, Morgan Cowling.
So I'm the last CCO. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ashlyn Strong, and I'm the Director of Public Policy and Communications for HealthShare of Oregon, the state's largest CCO serving more than 200,000 OHP members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. We submitted a letter of support on this bill in the House that remains on OLIS, and our testimony at that time still remains current today. So in an effort to save time, I'll be brief in my comments. Since then, the Oregon Health Authority has done a lot of work in analyzing processes that have caused concerns with the enrollment and renewals processes. Some of you may have seen the Oregon Health Authority's presentation in the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means. They did some really excellent work, and I would like to praise them for taking the time to really look into some of these issues and figuring out what's going on with creating concerns with Oregon Health Plan members re-enrolling in the Oregon Health Plan. As Martin Taylor mentioned, after completing this analysis, OHA has asked CCOs for ideas and suggestions for how they might improve enrollment processes, and this bill, I believe, is part of the CCO's response to that request for suggestions. It is not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve all of the problems, but it will go a long way to helping Oregon Health Plan members enroll and re-enroll in the Oregon Health Plan. As a CCO that has multiple CCOs in our service area, we would love to be able to help our members re-enroll, but I believe that the purpose of the exemption of having application assisters in the CCOs that have multiple CCOs in their service area was in order to avoid the appearance of bias or unfairness in enrolling members into those CCOs where there are multiple options. So we would support any effort to include CCOs that have multiple CCOs in their service area in that process, but it will take some conversation to figure out how to do that in a way that is most fair and doesn't bias any of our members. So we encourage your support for House Bill 2838 in taking steps to improve enrollment and renewal processes for Oregon Health Plan members. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I think members are all familiar with our mission of working to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities. Virtually all of the people that we wind up serving through with our attorneys throughout the state are OHP eligible or on OHP. When we go back in history a little ways and we think about what happened with Cover Oregon and the fact that we really had no technology, it was really people power that actually made things work. It was agents, assisters, OHP staff, and others that worked to help to enroll people. Particularly, I have a fondness for the application assisters because of the fact that many of the people that we work with have language barriers, disabling conditions, otherwise might be disenfranchised. And the idea about having somebody that really understands the issues because we know just enrolling and re-enrolling is a difficult process. We continue to have concerns. It's been mentioned a couple of times. I won't go into any depth about the fact that the enrollment and re-enrollment process for Oregon Health Plan is not perfect yet by any stretch of the imagination. But the idea about making sure that we have a strong network of application assisters will help. We've been a little bit concerned with the erratic nature of the funding for application assisters. And one person testifying mentioned that the funding for her position goes away. What this particular bill does is it makes it possible for CCOs to put money into a fund for application assistance. That might not be good enough for serving the entire population, the entire state, but I do think it's a step in the right direction. And then the gross bill talks about providing information to CCOs about member information, and I think that's particularly important for enrollment and re-enrollment purposes. So we're in favor of the bill. We acknowledge it's not a perfect solution, but I think it's very much a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group, also here in support of this important legislation. OSPIRG, since about 2013, has been the convener for an ad hoc network of organizations called the Oregon Outreach and Enrollment Alliance that has focused on advocacy around trying to make enrollment processes work better in the state and get the word out about the changes to enrollment and eligibility and so forth associated with the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things that we have heard throughout that process has been concerns about the erratic funding for enrollment assistance and along with a number of the programmatic concerns that have been already raised around OHA's own internal processes. But I've personally talked to a number of individual enrollment assisters and leaders of nonprofit groups that employ enrollment assisters who have been very concerned about the fact that they just haven't been able to plan for the future and whether they would be able to continue offering these services, which is really because of the erratic nature of the funding, because of the fact that decisions about funding sometimes happen really at the last minute when the funding for the previous year is about to run out. It's really just not possible for the kinds of nonprofit groups that do this work to continue doing it under those circumstances. And so some of them have unfortunately had to back off from doing this really important work. And this bill is again, not a perfect solution to that problem either, but it does provide a baseline commitment to make sure that there's a sufficient number of enrollment assisters, and it provides a mechanism to enable CCOs to provide support for that network of enrollment assisters. I think that the bill does, in fact, have sufficiently strong protections against enrollment assisters steering consumers toward specific CCOs, which is something we would be very concerned about if we thought that it was going to happen as a result of this bill. I think the protections in this bill and in existing law are pretty strong. And I'll just say, I think in the current environment, the need for enrollment assisters and in-person enrollment assistance is stronger than it's ever been. I think that the uncertainty, even just today, around the future of the Oregon Health Plan and the Affordable Care Act, is driving confusion, and consumers need access to this kind of assistance, let alone if something actually changes, if for example, the American Health Care Act currently being debated in Congress actually becomes law. It might seem like that would negate the need for some of this because there will be fewer people eligible for these services, but I actually think that the need will be stronger than ever. People will have tons of questions, and there will be a lot of very complicated cases where people need assistance. So I think this bill is very important, and I urge a yes vote.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Cowling, the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing the 34 local health departments across Oregon. I'm here today to support 2838A with an amendment that Martin Taylor mentioned that we've been working with CARE Oregon on. As the bill currently reads, it would allow nonprofit organizations to provide trained application assistance, and we have health departments across the state that are currently providing application assistance and have trained application assisters, and we wouldn't want this bill to have the unintended consequence of making less application assisters available throughout Oregon. So for that, we've been working on an amendment that would just take out the word nonprofit and allow organizations that have trained application assisters to be available and eligible for the grants. We're very encouraged to try and make sure that there's ongoing application assistance, and the goals of local health officials are to try and make sure that everyone gets on the Oregon Health Plan. So with that amendment, we're happy to support 2838A and would encourage the committee to do so as well. Thank you.
Great. I have an overall question. I mean, I'm trying to put myself in a person who's in OHP and needs to reapply. And I would think want to go right back to the CCO that I was in rather going to another entity. So when Art gave his testimony, they get calls, they can't do it. That means no other CCO can do that either. I want to know why, because that seems a little bit inefficient. Why?
I believe that it has to do with some federal law and some state rules, and part of the purpose of this bill is to respond to that and make it so that CCOs can help their existing members re-enroll, at least in areas where there's only one CCO in the service area, which is the vast majority of the state.
But you don't have the history of why it's the federal law, huh?
I think it has to do with, sorry, Chair and members of the committee, I think it has to do with the concerns about bias or certain managed care entities trying to steer members to that managed care entity rather than showing them all of the options that are available to them.
The ultimate goal is to get them enrolled in a CCO. If there's inequities, we could deal with that at another time. Yeah,
Senator. I would say that.
Justin, do you have, by the way, before, do you have answers to that question of why? Little. Okay.
Okay. Just a comment talking about the vast majority of the state. You're right if you're talking geographically, not population-wise, because half the population's in two.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an equity issue. I'm more concerned about getting them enrolled, and I really don't care about. I do care about equity, but if CCOs are doing their jobs and delivering good service, people are going to want to stay in that same CCO. I would hate to see them have to go into another process. Okay. All right. That's all we have for this bill. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2838A. And I've got to go slow on which bills we're going to open because we only have three of us here. Okay. is everyone okay with 2304?
I am.
Yeah, I'll go with you.
No. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2304.
We're going with the dash 3.
And we're going with the dash 3. And if you could explain that. And is there someone here? Nikki, do you want to come up just to keep us all on track here?
If Nikki's going to testify, I may not support it.
So. Come on up. All right, go ahead.
Yep. Members of the committee, House Bill 2304, brought to you by OHA. The bill received public hearing on April 13th. It expands the types of traditional health records recognized in Oregon by adding peer, family, and youth support specialists to the definition of peer wellness specialists. There is a fiscal impact statement that's issued. It's on OLIS, no revenue impact, and it did pass out of the House with 56 votes and the dash 3 amendment. It sounds like you're going to explain.
Okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Nikki Terzieff on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. The dash 3 is an expansion from 5, definition of 5 community health workers to 6, adding a certified advocate, so somebody who meets a victim and their family at the emergency
domestic
shelter.
Domestic violence.
Yes. Thank you, advocate. So meeting somebody at the emergency shelter, at the hospitals, in a courtroom. These are life navigators, which fits within the definition. Madam Chair, you asked me to go back to the House and just make sure that they were comfortable. We've met with all of the committee members from the original committee, House Healthcare, and they've all said great.
Great. Thank you. Okay. All right.
That wasn't bad, okay?
I didn't screw it up.
I'll give you a pass on this.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 Amendment dated 4/12/17 into House Bill 2304.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 4/12/17 into House Bill 2304. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Please mark Senator Beyer and Senator Steiner Hayward as excused. Amendment adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2304 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2304 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll. Excuse.
Senator
Canova. Aye.
Senator
Steiner Hayward.
Excuse. Vice
Chair
Cruz.
Aye. Senator Montana. Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2304. And let's see.
I can do that one.
Yeah, I think no controversy. Is anyone here to talk to about 2340?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead. So I'll open a work session on House Bill 2340A.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2340A is brought to you by DCBS. The bill allows DCBS to reduce the mandatory five-year ban applied to an insurer that discontinues offering health plan in a geographic area. There is a Dash 2 amendment. It sounds like DCBS staff will walk through what that is. No fiscal revenue impact. The bill passed out of the House unanimously, 60 votes. The committee has the paperwork.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager at DFR. Briefly, so this amendment is actually a continuation of work we started in the House. We had worked with some stakeholders to make sure that when this five-year ban, the shortening was applied, that there were sufficient sideboards and safeguards in place for bringing insurers back in. So really what the Dash A2 is saying is that we will adopt certain procedural documentary requirements to have that insurer make the case that they should come back before the five-year ban is expired.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A2 amendment into House Bill 2340A, dated 4/26/17.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A2 amendments dated 4/26/17 into House Bill 2340A. Any discussion? Any opposition? Please mark Senator Steiner Hayward as excused, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2340A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2340A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Barr?
Yes.
Senator Canova? Aye. Senator Steiner Hayward?
Excused.
Yes.
Aye. Motion carries. Does someone want to, Senator Beyer, would you want to carry this bill?
Oh, sure.
Okay. With that, I'll close the work session on 2340A. Let's see. The next one is, we'll have to carry over 2644A at this point in time.
Next one's fine.
Okay, let's open a work session on House Bill 2660A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2660A, brought to you by Representatives Bynum, Peluso, Kinnegar, Sanchez, and Senators Canope and Senator Hayward. The bill received a public hearing on April 11th. It directs the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Consumer Business Services to develop a website that provides information on breast cancer, breast cancer reconstruction options, and insurance coverage here in Oregon. There's a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendments, and the bill passed out unanimously of the House.
There, anyone that, do you need, is there any controversy on this?
We're good.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2660A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2660A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just briefly, I think at some point in time we may need to look at what information is available to women in their oncologist's office as well. because quite simply, that's where the decisions are made.
Yeah.
So, but this is a good first step.
Yeah, I know that OHA will add it to their website, and I know I would never go to DCBS's website to figure out my coverage, for crying out loud. I go to my own provider, but the proponents know my views on that one, and I hope that no one else is going to come forward and ask DCBS to start doing education on services. So. Where am I on that?
We can vote.
Oh, vote. Yes, let's have Annette call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And I know that Senator Knope and Senator Steiner Hayward were on the bill. Do you want to carry it?
I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
Elizabeth might want to as well.
Let's assign both.
No, let's
we
just.
Don't need to.
Let's just.
No. But, I mean, it's okay. Up to you. Whatever you want.
I want Senator Knope to carry the bill.
I will carry the bill.
Okay. Okay. All right. We'll close work session on House Bill 2660A and open. Let's see.
2931.
Who's here? Let's see. I'm. Who's here to talk about 2931?
Can we stand at ease for a minute?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
We'll stand at ease just for a minute.
Okay. Because I got a question I need to ask you.
Okay. Just a minute. We're at ease. Okay. We're going to reconvene the Senate Health Care Committee, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2931.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, House Bill 2931, the bill received a public hearing on May 2nd. The measure modifies requirements to register as a behavioral analysis interventionist in Oregon. No amendments, no fiscal revenue impact.
And you had a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what was confusing in this bill for me was current statute requires this person to have a high school diploma or a GED. And go through some training, and we're adding or a degree from a post-secondary institution, and I'm thinking that's even a step above. Okay, so the mix just didn't sound right to me, but as it has been explained to me, there are some folks who don't have access to their diplomas or GEDs, and so if they had a post-secondary degree, that should qualify them for something. So now that I've had it explained, Madam Chair, I'm okay.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, Annette, please call the roll.
Leave that decision up to the end.
We need a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we had a motion.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2931 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2931 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Yes.
Senator Pinnell.
Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monis-Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and I guess I'm next on the list. I'll carry the bill. We'll close the work session, House Bill 2931. And let's see, what's the next one?
3404.
Yeah.
Okay, oh yes. Open a work session on House Bill 3404A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 3404A, brought to you by Representative Malmstrom. The bill received a public hearing on May 2nd. The measure requires children under the age of 2 to be properly secured with the child safety system in a rear-facing position. Exempts children who are 1 year or older immediately before effective date of the act. Declares emergency. No amendments. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact. Both statements are lawless. And the bill passed out of the House with 48 yes votes, no 9 votes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3404A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz.
No, excuse me. Yeah, that's no, I'm right.
Yeah, you're right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3404A
right
to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Yes.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Yes.
Chair Monis-Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries. And I know Senator Knope was on the original bill, and so was I, but I'd just as soon have you carry
okay.
it if you'd like it.
I'll carry.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 3404A.
We're good on the next one.
And, oh, yes, this is a good one. All right, we'll open the work session on House Bill 3439.
As opposed to the other ones?
Yeah. We do the good ones, and then we do the bad ones.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, is House Bill 3439, brought to you by Representatives Malmstrom, Kinnemer, and Holvey. The bill received a public hearing on May 4th. The measure allows physician assistants and nurse practitioners to have equal or majority ownership in professional corporations organized principally for the purpose of practicing medicine. There's no limits, no fiscal revenue impact, and passed out of the House unanimously, and the committee has the paperwork.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3439A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3439A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3439. We're having a constitutional problem with 2644, so let's carry that bill over to next. Is it Monday? Can we do that?
Tuesday.
I mean, correct. Next Tuesday. Yeah. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.
He's going to have to get unconstitutionally unlocked.
Adjourned.
He's going to have to get unconstitutionally unlocked.